Whether he understood it perfectly, but he couldn't believe it was Jake, that Jake could say such things to a girl. He felt suddenly sick with lust and longing. He was 21 and hadn't touched a girl in his life. Jake still suffered pain sometimes, usually in the evening. Arthur could tell by the way he kept shifting his position, trying to get comfortable. He would stand up, walk around, sit down again, move his shoulders restlessly. He never complained about it, though. Arthur almost wished he would. Jake's stoicism made him feel worse. He was no longer waiting hour by hour for Jake to tell their parents what had happened on the bridge. He didn't know why the axe hadn't fallen, but it hadn't, and it didn't feel imminent. Maybe Jake was biding his time, hoarding the revelation like money in the bank. Or maybe he didn't intend to tell them directly. Maybe he had decided that it was more valuable to have something to hold over Arthur, a debt that he could call in when the time was right.
"The Jackson boy is home,"
Arthur's mother said, piling potatoes onto her husband's plate.
"But he's lost an arm, according to Annie, and Stan and Helen Wallace's boy is still not well enough to travel."
She piled the beans and carrots high. One good thing about living on a mixed farm was that food rationing didn't affect them. But her lips were tight. Arthur noticed that little lines radiated out around them as if she'd pursed them too often lately at too much bad news.
"The thing is, you get used to it. We're all getting used to it. Is this enough, Henry?"
A nod from Arthur's father.
"To hearing these things, I mean. No one takes any notice anymore. It's as if all these deaths and all these horrible injuries are normal. You hardly even feel shocked anymore. It's terrible. You should at least feel shocked. Pass me a plate, Arthur."
She began forking fat slices of beef onto Arthur's plate.
"And you know what else? They're turning Hamborough, what used to be Hamborough, into a prison for prisoners of war. They're sending German prisoners all the way over here and putting them in special camps. Some of them are being sent to the prison in Monteith. Jake, how much meat would you like?"
"Just a slice," Jake said.
"Hamborough? You mean the old ghost town?" "Yeah, some of the buildings are still good, apparently. So they're putting the prisoners there. I don't think it's a good idea. What if they escape?"
"Are you sure you can't eat another slice, Jakey?" Jake flinched. He hated it when she called him that. "Yes, I'm sure."
"Well, have lots of potatoes."
She ladled potatoes onto his plate.
"I don't think having escaped prisoners roaming around the woods is a good idea."
"Won't there be guards?" Jake said.
"That's too much, Mum. I can't eat all that."
"Try," his mother said, gently urging. She worried about him all the time, Arthur knew, every minute of the day. The war, the death of the Luntz boys, hadn't changed that. In fact, it had made things worse. With boys dying by the thousands, how could hers be spared? Fate must have something else in store for them. Specifically for Jake. Jake was the one she worried about. Arthur understood that. It had always been so, and now more than ever. He didn't blame her. Jake was always in the background of his mind, too, a shadow tinged with guilt.
"The veterans' guards are going to guard them," their mother said. "But they'll fall asleep. They're old men."
Jake gave a snort of laughter. He ate a slice of beef, one potato, and about half a carrot, and then pushed back his chair.
"I'm off," he said.
Sometimes Arthur wondered if he ate so little because he knew how it distressed her.
"Aren't you having dessert? It's pie."
"I'll have some later."
"Where are you going?"
"Out." He patted her head and was gone. The screen door slammed behind him. Into the silence of the room, his mother said,
"Do you think he's happy? With us, I mean? Is he happy here with us?"
Arthur looked at her and saw desolation in her eyes. One evening, at the beginning of May, Otto Luntz came over to tell them that he and Gertie were going away.
"I don't know how long," he said.
He sat down at the table and accepted the cup of tea Arthur's mother set down before him.
Maybe a while. Gertie's sister in Oshawa. We go stay with her. Maybe we sell the farm. I don't know.
He looked from one to the other of them. His expression was so bleak that it was hard not to look away.
I be glad you look after things, he said. I pay, of course.
We don't want no money from you, Otto, Arthur's father said. We'll be happy to look after things as much as we can. He sounded anxious, though. There was a limit to how much they could do. But Otto understood that. He said,
Important thing is the pigs. I know you can't do more land, but I think maybe if you use my tractor, you can do some little more. You get my fuel ration, too. Then you get horses and a tractor.
Arthur and his father looked at each other doubtfully. They had never wanted a tractor, didn't care how fast it was, how efficient. They told themselves it wasn't worth the money. Otto had borrowed heavily from the bank to buy his, and in the early stages it kept breaking down, costing him even more. But the simple truth was that they hadn't liked the idea of it, hadn't wanted a big, ugly, noisy machine crawling across their land. If you compared it to the horses, who knew their work so well, who were quiet and companionable, and fertilized the land as they went instead of compacting the soil or churning it into a sea of mud every time it rained, the horses won hands down. But now, if they had Otto's land to consider as well as their own...
We ain't neither of us driven a tractor before, Arthur's father said, as if hoping that would excuse them. I show you tomorrow. Otto said. It is not difficult.
So the next day he showed them, and it wasn't difficult. Both Arthur and his father had a turn driving it up and down the Lunces' driveway, and it seemed pretty straightforward, like a truck, but bigger. So it was settled. The Dunns would look after the farm as well as they could, and keep a share, unwillingly, of the profits, and Otto and Gertie would take their time over deciding what to do next. Though they all knew they were saying goodbye for good, that the next time the Lunces came to Struan, it would be merely to clear out the house. Otto brought the tractor over on the morning he and Gertie left. What with the strain of the farewells, nobody paid it any attention. But after the Lunces had gone, they all went and had a closer look at it, even Jake. It might be for farm work, but it had wheels. And Jake liked wheels.
It just makes me think of those boys, Arthur's mother said. She was red-eyed, and her voice was clogged as if she had a cold. I'll never see it without thinking of them.
No point dwelling on it, Arthur's father said. It don't help.
I know it doesn't help.
Her voice was sharp with unhappiness.
But it's a fact.
Doesn't look as strong as two horses, Arthur said, to change the subject, though it did look pretty strong.
It didn't look as friendly as the horses, though, that was for sure. Jake was wandering around it, patting the huge tires, drawing a line along the dusty flanks with his finger.
I'm glad it's red, he said with satisfaction. Red's the right color for a tractor.
He climbed up and sat on the seat and grinned down at them.
Bet it's fun to drive, he said. Wonder how fast it can go. Whew! We should take it out on the road and see what it'll do.
It's not a toy, his father said sharply, in the voice he used to use with Jake. And Jake flushed. He said,
That was a joke, Dad. I was making a joke.
It's dinner time, his mother said. Maybe after dinner you can all try it.
But maybe, Jake guessed, he wouldn't get to drive it, because after dinner he wandered off like he always did. Arthur's mother did the dishes as usual, and Arthur and his father retired to the armchairs for a few minutes to let the food go down, though maybe for a little less time than usual, because, although they wouldn't have admitted it even to each other, they were both quite excited about the tractor.
"Looks bigger than it did before dinner," Arthur said when they went out to it again. "Won't look no smaller tomorrow," his father said. "Might as well give her a go."
He climbed up, stiffly,
placing his feet on the plates with deliberation, and made to sit down, then hesitated and looked down at Arthur.
"You want to go first?"
Arthur shook his head.
"You sure?"
"Yeah."
"Okay, here goes."
He started the engine, as Otto had shown him, and it fired up with a roar. He and Arthur grinned at each other. He put it into gear, and the huge wheels started turning. He grasped the steering wheel tightly with both hands, and yelled,
"I'll take her down to the lower 40.
Arthur nodded and watched him drive off.
"I hope he's careful," his mother said.
Her voice made Arthur jump. He hadn't heard her coming up behind him.
"I'll follow him down," he said. "See how he's making out."
"Tell him not to go so fast," his mother said. "I'm going over to the Lunces to look at Otto's pigs, just to make sure they're all right. If you drive it, Arthur, you be careful."
He set off, following in the tread marks of the tractor. His father was out of sight already. He did seem to be driving kind of fast. But then that was the thing about tractors, they were fast. Otto reckoned he could plow 4 to 5 acres in the time it took a team of horses to do one. Maybe they would end up buying it when Otto came to sell things off. It was noisy, though. He wasn't keen on the noise. His father must be 3 fields away by now, but you could still hear the roar. And then, all at once, the pitch changed. The roar wavered, and then rose and kept climbing until it was more like a scream. Arthur frowned, wondering what his father was doing. Did he have it in the wrong gear? Suddenly, uneasy, he walked faster, then broke into a run. The scream went on. He passed the tractor many times when Carl or one of the others was plowing, and he'd never heard it make that noise before. When he got to the brow of the hill, he couldn't see it at first. He stopped and looked around. He could hear it louder than ever. The high scream kept on, and the tread marks were there, running fairly straight down the side of the field, but there was no sign of the tractor, just some big brownish black thing sticking up out of the ditch at the bottom of the field. And then he realized what it was and started running and shouting at the same time, "Dad! Dad!" just as he had shouted all those years ago when the baby was coming and his mother was in danger, running and shouting now as then with fear clutching his heart. The tractor had rolled right over so that the wheels were spinning in the air. His father was underneath it. All Arthur could see was his head and neck. He was face up, and his face was purple, and his eyes were bulging, and his mouth was gaping wide. Arthur leapt down into the ditch and grabbed hold of the side of the tractor, keeping clear of the monstrous wheels, and braced his legs and heaved with all his strength. The tractor didn't move one fraction of an inch.
"Hold on, Dad! Hold on!"
Arthur yelled, his voice cracking with disbelief and terror. The tractor was still screaming like an animal. He turned so that his back was against it, and reached behind himself and braced his legs against the side of the ditch and lifted, put all of his huge strength into it, and lifted, roaring with the effort. Was there a movement? He didn't know, but he thought there might have been, and he couldn't let the tractor down again because then all of that weight would be back on his father. He roared,
"Jesus! Jesus!"
And as if in answer, there was a movement at the top of the ditch, and Jake was there, white and staring with shock. Jake jumped down and reached up swiftly and turned off the engine, and the silence screamed as loud as the engine had. Jake grabbed hold of the tractor and tried to lift it as well, but his strength was nothing and made no difference at all.
"Get the horses!"
Arthur roared at him. His legs were shuddering with the strain. What if he couldn't keep it up? What was the point of his size and strength if he couldn't keep the weight of the tractor from crushing his father? Jake nodded and scrambled up the side of the ditch as fast as his limp would allow, and at the top, spared a fraction of a moment to look back. He stopped. Arthur roared,
"Get the bloody horses!"
But Jake slid back down the slope and put his hand on Arthur's arm. He said, "Art, he's dead." His voice was shaking and his lips were bluish with shock. Arthur glanced down and saw the dreadful color of his father's face and the way his eyes bulged, and saw now that blood was running from his mouth. But that didn't mean he was dead. None of it meant he was dead. It just meant they had to get the weight off him so that he could breathe. "Get the bloody horses," he bellowed again, and Jake hesitated, then nodded, and scrambled up the side of the ditch once more and disappeared. Arthur waited, sweat pouring down him, shoulders back and legs trembling violently, saying over and over again, "Hold on, Dad, hold on. He'll be right back, just hold on." Then Jake was there again with two of the horses, and their harnesses and ropes and all that was needed. Grant him that, in this one instance Jake did all that was needed, and did it fast and did it well. And they hauled the tractor off their father's broken body, and Arthur, sobbing now, carried him across the fields and into the house. Arthur's mother said, "I didn't think it would be him. I thought one of you would be taken from me. I never thought it would be him. I thought we would have years and years together. I thought we would grow old together." Jake said, "I thought when I grew up and got a job somewhere doing something important, he'd see I wasn't useless. You want to know the truth? I hate him for dying before he learned I wasn't useless. That's the truth." As for Arthur, he had no words. Chapter 9. May remove wolf bounty. Expert warns, silage is tricky. Temiskaming Speaker, May 1960. They'd been standing beside the vegetable patch when the Cadillac pulled into the farmyard. They all started moving toward it, but then the door opened and a man got out, and Laura stopped so suddenly that Ian bumped into her. "Jake," she said. "Just that." Ian looked from her to the stranger curiously. The stranger's smile widened. He was leaning against his car, arms folded, weight on one leg. He was wearing a suit, something you didn't see all that often in Struan, and very clean shoes. "Hello, Laura," he said. "How are things down on the farm?" It sounded like a joke, rather than a question, and maybe that was how Laura took it, too, because she didn't answer. The man's eyes moved from her to the baby she was holding, and then to Ian, and Julie, and finally to March. 1, 2, 3, 4, he said musingly, nodding at each of them. "You've been busy." His gaze moved back to Ian, and he tipped his head to one side. He was still smiling, but he looked puzzled. "You're Carter?" he said. The question seemed to fluster Laura. She switched the baby from one hip to the other and said, "No, no, he's not. I'm sorry. I should have introduced you. This is Ian, Dr. Christofferson's son. He helps Arthur in the summers. And this one isn't mine. I'm just looking after him for the afternoon. Ian, this is Jake, Arthur's brother." She hesitated, then said, "You should have written, Jake. You should have told us you were coming. That would have spoiled the surprise." He stepped forward and extended his hand to Ian. "I didn't think there was much family resemblance," he said. Ian shook hands. "Nice to meet you." 3 summers now he'd been working on the farm, and never once had anyone mentioned Arthur having a brother. "Carter isn't here right now," Laura said. "He'll be back soon, and Arthur's out in the fields." Jake laughed. "Where else?" he said. "How's he doing?" "Oh, fine," Laura said. "He's doing just fine. We're all fine." Jake was looking around the farmyard curiously. "The old place isn't looking too bad. Barn looks good. Is that new?"
"About 5 years old, I think. About 5 years."
There was a pause.
Laura said, You must be hungry, Jake. How far have you come today? Would you like something to eat? Supper's still a long way off. You'll stay for supper, won't you? But in the meantime..."
Her voice trailed off. She seemed nervous, Ian thought. She was being polite to Jake in the way that you're polite to a stranger or someone you're uncomfortable with. Jake was smiling at her again. "I stopped in town and had a look around.
Had a piece of pie in Harper's. But sure, I'll stay for supper. In fact, I was hoping you could put me up for a day or two.
Oh, of course, Laura said hurriedly. Of course, you must stay as long as you like.
She looked down at Julie and said, This is your Uncle Jake, honey. Say hello, Uncle Jake.
Hello,
Julie whispered.
Hi, Jake whispered back. You look like your mom. Did you know that?
Julie shook her head. You're a lucky girl, Jake said, and winked at her. Julie smiled shyly, and Jake turned back to Laura. Maybe I'll just take my suitcases in and then go and find Art.
Oh, you mustn't go out to the fields, Laura said hastily. It's very muddy. You'll ruin your shoes. Ian will go and get him, won't you, Ian?
Sure, Ian said. He noticed now that Jake had a limp. Polio? An accident? His father would know.
We'll go together, Jake said cheerfully. The shoes will survive. I want to surprise Art.
He opened the trunk of the car and lifted out two suitcases. Ian stepped forward and took them, feeling like a lackey. Jake grinned at him. If you insist, he said, you can charge Art extra. Additional services rendered. Ian took the bags into the kitchen and put them by the stairs. Through the window he could see Laura and Jake still talking, or maybe Laura was just listening. She was holding the baby in front of her now and was watching Jake over the top of its head. March was circling her, around and around, eyeing the stranger. As Ian watched, Laura put her free hand on his head and drew him toward her. He put his arms around her knees and she stroked his hair. Julie was still beside her, so she seemed to be wrapped in children. It made quite a picture, Ian thought. It would be called The Mother. Though there was something about the scene that wasn't as reassuring as that title suggested. He went to the door, and Jake saw him and jerked his head backward, meaning, Come on, let's go, so Ian went out and joined them.
Ian knows which field he's in, Laura was saying as he came up. He'll be so glad to see you, Jake.
She wasn't all that pleased herself, Ian thought. He wondered if Jake was aware of it, but he looked perfectly at ease. They started off down the track, Ian being careful not to walk too fast. The limp was quite pronounced.
So, Jake said, how long have you been working for my big brother, then?
About 3 years.
And is he a good employer?
Something about the idea seemed to amuse him.
Yes, he's great, Ian said. He's a really nice guy.
Oh, sure, Jake said, nodding. Sure, no one could accuse Art of not being nice. He looked sideways at Ian and added, He's got a nice wife, too, hasn't he?
Ian looked at him quickly, and Jake laughed. That's what I figured.
Ian felt his face go hot. He stuck his hands in his pockets, then pulled them out again. She's a really nice woman, he said. And Jake laughed again and slapped him on the back.
Don't worry, he said. I won't tell on you. We'll change the subject. You're Dr. Christofferson's son. I don't remember him having kids. How old are you, 17, 18?
18, Ian said.
Well, you were around then. I've been gone, let's see, about 15 years, I guess.
Did you leave to go to college? Ian asked, anxious to keep the conversation on this relatively safe course. Jake looked to be in his mid-30s now, so he'd have been the right sort of age. It would probably have been unusual for a farm kid to get to college back then, but he could have won a scholarship. You could see he was smart.
Thought about it, Jake said, but decided against it. It was a bit too, you know.
Ian didn't know, but it seemed impolite to say so. Besides, my father was dead by then, and Art was running this place. He was doing all right financially. He had a good war, as they say, but still, it didn't seem right to ask him to shell out for me. They'd come to a gate, and he stood back and waited for Ian to open it. The ground was a soggy mix of mud and cow dung, and Jake picked his way carefully. Ian squelched through it. His boots were so caked with mud already they couldn't get any worse.
"I've done fine without it," Jake went on. "A formal education's not much use in the real world."
He was using little hummocks of grass as stepping stones, searching for the next one, but he spared a moment to glance at Ian.
"But I imagine you're the academic type. You off to college soon?" Yes, Ian said, feeling vaguely ashamed of being so predictable. In the fall.
To do what? Jake asked.
I'm not sure yet.
Well, it doesn't make much difference. Just get out of here. That's the important thing.
He waved a hand at the surrounding landscape.
Out of Struan, out of the north, out of the goddamned bush.
Ian grinned at him, and Jake grinned back.
You know what I mean?
Definitely. There was a big clump of grass beside the path, and Jake stepped onto it and wiped his shoes.
Where are you thinking of going?
Probably Toronto. All these questions. Jake had asked more questions in 10 minutes than Arthur had asked in 3 years. Jake frowned.
Seems a bit of a waste, doesn't it?
Does it? In what way?
Well, it's a bit safe, don't you think? Toronto's nothing. How about somewhere a little more exciting? How about New York, Los Angeles? Hell, why not go to China? They have universities there. See the world.
Ian stared at him, and Jake laughed.
Got you thinking, haven't I? I'm serious, though. You could go anywhere, smart kid like you. Grab your chance in both hands, buddy, and run.
They'd come over the brow of the hill now, and the 10 acre spread out before them. Arthur was on the far side of the field. The horses were at a standstill, and he was squatting down beside the seed drill fiddling with something. Probably it was jammed. You had to keep an eye on it.
The man himself, Jake said, and he still has the horses. Incredible!
Arthur must have heard something because he straightened up and looked in their direction. He stood for a moment or two, evidently trying to figure out who the stranger was, and then he must have worked it out, maybe he saw the limp, because he started across the field to meet them. Jake speeded up, as much as the limp would allow, hurrying toward his brother. Ian followed, slowly, thinking about what Jake had said. It was true. He could go anywhere. No one had ever said that before. The teachers asked such limiting questions and made such limited suggestions. They said, "What do you want to do?" by which they simply meant, "What subject do you want to study?" And when you replied, they said things like, "Oh, Sudbury is close, and it has a good course in that." Or if you were lucky, "Toronto has a good reputation in that field." In their thinking, they never left the province, far less the country. It would cost more to go further, but probably not that much more. Maybe it took someone from outside to point out that there was a world out there. Jake and Arthur were walking toward him across the field, and Ian realized that he'd missed the reunion. He'd wanted to see Arthur's reaction to his brother turning up out of nowhere, but he'd forgotten to watch. They were walking side by side, Jake talking animatedly, gesturing with his hands, glancing sideways up at Arthur, while at the same time picking his way across the muddy field. He looked very slight beside Arthur, very sharp in his suit and his city shoes, sharper than his brother in every way. Arthur wasn't saying much, but there was nothing new in that. As for whether he was pleased to see Jake, it was impossible to tell. Ian would have liked to go fishing with Pete that evening. He hadn't spoken to him since their discussion after the math exam, and he wanted to get things straightened out. But he and Kathy were back to going steady again, and he'd promised her they'd go for a cheeseburger at Harper's when he got back from the farm. So he had a bath and changed into clean jeans and a T-shirt, and then got back on his bike. Kathy was sitting cross-legged on the porch of her parents' house waiting for him. Her mother was in the kitchen. Ian saw her at the window and waved, and she gave him a wave back. She and Kathy's father approved of him, according to Kathy, even though he went to the wrong church. But Ian suspected that was because of who his father was. Being the doctor's son gave you a head start with people's parents. "What kept you so long?" Kathy said severely. She was wearing a blouse, the same pale pink as her cheeks. Each time Ian saw her afresh, he was reminded of why the other guys at school envied him. Maybe she wasn't all that deep a thinker, but she made up for it in other ways, like looks and general amenability.
"Some of us have to work," he said, parking his bike against the side of the porch.
"Did you plant lots of corn?"
"No, but I weeded lots of weeds."
"I'll forgive you, then."
She got to her feet and came down the steps and slipped her arm through his. Then she turned and waved to her mother.
"Where should we go?" she said.
Ian said, "I was thinking of the Ritz."
"Oh, I'm tired of the Ritz. Can't we go somewhere else?"
"Well, let's think. There's a place called Harper's that's supposed to be really in at the moment."
"Oh, yes, let's go there."
She was so happy since they'd got back together. So easy to please.
"One more exam," she said, taking his hand and swinging it high. "Just one. And then our school days are over forever, and our real lives begin. Can you believe it? I can hardly believe it."
"I know," Ian said. "All the exams finished on Monday. Geography, which Kathy took in the morning, and chemistry, which he took in the afternoon. That was it. Less than 2 days, and they'd be finished. The whole class was going out to Lowdown Point in the evening for the celebration, to end all celebrations."
"Aren't you excited?" Kathy demanded. "I'm so excited about next year, I can hardly sleep anymore."
"Yeah," Ian said. "Me too."
She pouted at him. "You don't sound very excited."
"I am, though." She was so enthusiastic. That was the problem. Her enthusiasm wore him out. Ron Atkinson and Fats Fitzpatrick were already at Harper's when they arrived, hunkered down in the booth by the door. Fats had his foot up on the opposite bench. He tried to pull a sock on over the bandages, but they were too fat, so the sock was just crammed over his toes like a little hat.
"It's the man himself," Ron said, "with the woman herself. What do you know?"
Fats said, "Hey, I'm glad to see you, Christofferson. I need to ask you something. When I want to have a bath or a shower or something, do I take off the bandage or leave it on?"
"Whichever you like, Fats," Ian said. "I don't mind a bit."
He steered Kathy toward a booth at the far end of the room.
"But I need to know," Fats yelled after him. "Just keep it dry,"
Ian yelled back.
"Your dad must get so tired of that sort of thing,"
Kathy said under her breath, sliding into her seat.
"Everywhere he goes, people must ask him questions about their health. I wish there was somewhere else we could go, somewhere we could be more private."
Susan Jankowitz came over to their table. She worked in Harper's on Saturdays. She'd been in tears after the math exam, but she seemed to have recovered.
"What'll it be, children?" she said,
her pencil poised over her notepad. She was wearing a white blouse that needed more buttons.
"Are you going to order?"
Kathy said, raising her eyebrows at him. He was neglecting his duty.
"Oh, sure. 2 cheeseburgers with everything except onions."
Kathy thought onion breath was revolting.
"1 milkshake," he looked at her. "Strawberry or chocolate?"
"Chocolate."
"And 1 Coke and a double portion of fries."
Susan nodded, scribbling fast. When she left, Kathy looked around as if she'd never been here before. She was wearing a wistful expression.
"We're going to miss it, you know," she said.
"Miss what?"
"All this."
She gestured at the dark wooden booths with their stained red plastic cushioned seats, the red formica tables, the walls festooned with photos of happy fishermen holding up big fish, paper placemats with more fish swirling about the edges, fishing lines coming out of their mouths. Above the door to the toilets there was a 3-foot-long muskie stuffed and nailed to the wall.
"When we're older, we look back on this place and realize it was beautiful."
"Harper's?" Ian said.
"Even Harper's," Kathy said earnestly. "We'll look back and we'll realize that our childhoods were beautiful, and everything in them was beautiful, right down to—"
she looked about her—
"right down to the holes in these cushions. We'll realize that Struan was the most wonderful place in the world to grow up in. We'll realize that wherever we go, wherever we live for the rest of our lives, it will never be as perfect as here."
A little worm of irritation rose up in Ian from somewhere about mid-chest.
"Maybe we'd better not go,"
he said, twisting his mouth in a smile. He reminded himself about her looks and her general amenability. It didn't work. The fact was, her sentimentality had really started to get on his nerves lately. It was too much. It struck him as fake, and her expectation that he would feel the same made it more irritating still. It made him want to swing in the other direction, deny feeling things that he actually felt.
"But we have to go," Kathy leaned toward him earnestly.
"We don't have to go. Most of the kids we started school with aren't going."
Yes, but people like us have to go. You know that.
Susan set down their cheeseburgers and the drinks, and Kathy smiled up at her. Ian bit into his cheeseburger. It was very good. He wouldn't remember Harper's for its beauty. He'd remember it for its cheeseburgers.
You, of all people, Kathy was saying, you have so much potential, Ian. You couldn't develop it here. You need to spread your wings. We both do.
He wished she would stop talking. If she would just shut up, it would all be fine.
Don't you think it's amazing that we found each other? She said. I mean, what are the chances, really, in a town this size? We're so lucky.
Mmm, he said, around the cheeseburger. Kathy still hadn't touched hers.
Of finding each other?
Surely it was the chances of missing each other that were remote.
The chances of finding the person you want to spend your life with in a little tiny town, out of all the people in the world and all the places in the world, that one person happens to grow up in the same town as you.
She sighed.
You know what my mother said? She said she'd never seen me look so happy as I've looked since we got back together. Don't you think that's lovely?
Ian nodded. He picked up a fistful of fries and stuck them in his mouth. Kathy leaned across the table toward him. She was looking very serious all at once.
I had a talk with them last night, with my parents. They were saying they thought it was time I decided where I'm going next year, which school of nursing. They think I should get my application in.
She took his hand and turned it palm upward and studied it. It was greasy from the fries, and she frowned and pulled a napkin out of the dispenser on the table and began cleaning each finger in turn. Ian chewed his fries very thoroughly and swallowed them. The conversation was making him uneasy. "Haven't you decided?" he said. With his other hand, he gathered more fries. He had a sudden urge to stuff the whole plateful in his mouth. "Well?"
No.
She crumpled up the napkin and pulled out another.
I can't, can I? Until you do. Your career is more important than mine. Mum and Dad understand that. They completely understand that. I can do nursing anywhere, so it doesn't really matter, but they think it's time we decided. You know, so we're sure to get our first choice?
Ian paused, the fries halfway to his mouth. He put them down again and looked at them. It was as if she had opened a door in her head and showed him everything that was going on in there, the picture she was working on. She said,
Ian?
Her voice was puzzled. She released her hold on his hand and he withdrew it carefully. He began aligning the fries in a neat little row on the side of the plate, prodding them this way and that until they were level along the bottom. He pushed one end of the row of fries together so that they made a fan shape. After a while, he heard her get up from the table. He saw the movement at the periphery of his vision. She slid out of the booth, and he heard her footsteps receding down the aisle. He got to his feet and dug a fistful of coins out of his pocket and put them down beside the plates, hers still untouched, and followed her out. As he passed their booths, Fats and Ron Atkinson whistled slowly, and Ron said, "Hey, lover boy, what have you done now?" He followed Kathy down the street at a distance. He didn't want to catch up with her while there were still people about. When she turned down the road she lived on, he caught up with her. She tried to walk away, but he got in front of her, saying, "Wait, Kath, wait." She stepped this way and that, trying to get around him, and then gave up and just stood there, her arms at her sides. He took her hand and led her over to the side of the road. A tree had come down in a storm earlier in the year, and the trunk was still lying there, waiting to be cut up. He sat on it and gently pulled her down beside him. He told her he wasn't ready to make decisions about his future yet. He said maybe he was very immature or something, but he really wasn't ready for that, so he thought it would be best if they broke it off. She was crying. She asked if it was something she'd done, something she'd said, and he said no, it wasn't her at all, it was him. She said she'd tried to be different. She loved him so much that she'd be anything he wanted, and he shook his head, appalled. She said she didn't want to tie him down, but couldn't they just go on as they were? And he said no, he was sorry.
He was really sorry. It was a while before she pulled herself together, but finally she did. She took a deep breath and wiped her face with her fingers, looking straight in front of her, chin raised. Then she stood up. Ian stood up too, and asked if she wanted him to walk the rest of the way home with her. She said no, so he stayed where he was, and watched her walk away. Once, when he was a small child, a Sunday school teacher had taught a lesson on being good. She'd said it was sometimes difficult to know the right thing to do. It could be hard to tell good from bad, right from wrong, but, she had added, speaking in the hushed but cheerful voice that Sunday school teachers always seemed to use, there was one foolproof way to tell. All you had to do was ask yourself what Jesus would have done. You worked out what Jesus would do in any situation, and then you did it, and it was sure to be right. He'd forgotten the lesson the minute the class was over, but now it came back to him. He saw that for the past 3 years he had been working on a variation of that idea. In any tricky personal situation, he had asked himself what his mother would have done, and then he had done the opposite. It seemed to him that she was the perfect anti-role model. She hadn't cared how much she hurt the people who loved and depended on her. She had put her own desires above those of everyone else. She had lied and pretended and deceived. He had made part of his own personal code of behavior never to behave as she had done, and yet, when it came to it, he had treated Kathy much the same. He hadn't exactly cheated on her, unless you counted loving Laura from afar, but he had allowed her to think he loved her when he didn't, which amounted to the same thing. It scared him that he'd ended up behaving like his mother. It made him wonder if at some deep, unalterable level he resembled her. He went home. He had left his bike at Kathy's. He'd have to pick it up sometime when she wasn't around. When he got in, there was a note from his father on the kitchen table with a name, Lefebvre, and a phone number. He always left a note in case of emergencies, and the words, "yet another," scribbled at the bottom, by which he meant another baby. He seemed to be delivering babies every other night at the moment. It was practically an epidemic. Ian went down to the dock. It was very peaceful there. It wasn't dark yet, and the low clouds gave the lake a metallic sheen. He flipped the canoe over, slid it into the water, and climbed in. He paddled down the shore, keeping close in, the canoe sliding silently through the water. There was a cold mist stealing across the lake ahead of the night. Ian laid his paddle across the canoe and did up his jacket. The canoe was drifting toward the old beaver lodge at the entrance to Lowdown Bay. It had been abandoned for a number of years, but the beavers had returned the previous fall, and the stark white branches of the birches they'd brought down were sticking up out of the water like bones. He sat motionless for a while, wondering if he'd catch sight of a beaver, but there was no sign of them. Spring wasn't their busy time. They did most of their building in the fall. The females would be having their young about now, curled up, safe and dry in the depths of the lodge. He turned the canoe and paddled out around the point. He thought about the year to come, saw himself walking down a city street, cars roaring past, the stink of exhaust fumes, people jostling against him, no silence anywhere. He thought about Arthur's brother waving his arm and saying, "Out of Struan, out of the north, out of the goddamn bush." On one level, he agreed with him completely. On another level, he wasn't sure he would survive. He rounded the point that formed the eastern shore of Hopeless Inlet, and sure enough, the Queen Mary was there, Pete hunched over his fishing line like always. Ian came up slowly, careful not to disturb the water. "How's it going?" he said quietly.
"So-so," Pete said.
There were half a dozen trout in the bottom of the boat. "Doesn't look too bad," Ian said, nodding at them. "Chicken shit, man." Ian couldn't assess his tone. He didn't know if he was welcome or not. Until a week ago, he wouldn't have given the matter a thought. He'd have tied the canoe to the Queen Mary and climbed in. His rod was still where he'd left it, sticking out over the stern.
Was that a good sign? Maybe Pete hadn't even noticed it.
"You reckon he's still down there, eh?" Ian said.
"Yep."
"Still think he's a muskie?"
"Yep."
"You actually seen him?"
"Nope."
Ian slid the canoe back and forth with his paddle. He wasn't sure what he was waiting for. An invitation? Pete to say, "Aren't you going to fish?" Whatever it was, it didn't come.
"Good luck," he said finally.
Pete looked at him for a moment, then nodded, "Thanks." His father was in the kitchen when he got home, eating a hunk of cheese straight from the fridge.
"Hi," Ian said, grateful that he was back. "How did it go?"
"A bouncing baby boy."
"Are the proud parents happy?"
"Not especially. They've got 9 already."
"Good grief."
The fridge was open. The Irish stew Mrs. Tuttle had left for them was on a shelf beside a very large jar containing 1 dill pickle.
"We could heat that up," Ian said, nodding at the stew.
She made a double dose of it every Friday to see them through the weekend. Sometimes she called it something else, a casserole, that was her new word for it, but it was always the same stew.
"We could," his father agreed.
"Are you that hungry?"
"Not really."
"Me neither. Have some cheese." His father cut another hunk of cheese and handed it to him, then studied him for a moment.
"Everything all right?"
"Yeah, well, sort of. I broke up with Kathy."
"Oh, that's too bad." He didn't say again, which was nice of him. He was good about things like that.
"Yeah, it wasn't going anywhere. We don't have enough in common." His father nodded. The absence of Ian's mother drifted into the room.
"Plus, there's something wrong with Pete," Ian said quickly. "Not wrong, exactly. Strange. I don't know what it is."
His father said, "This is a tough time for him, you know. It's always difficult having a foot in both camps, but when there's trouble between the camps, it's really hard."
"I guess."
Though it seemed to him that if you'd been friends for the whole of your life, you were entitled not to be seen as part of a camp. He wished he and Pete could talk about it, properly get it out in the open. But that would never happen. Their relationship was based on things not said, and the more important something was, the less likely they were to discuss it.
"What does his grandfather think about it all? Jim Lightfoot being arrested and everything?"
Ian knew his father had a lot of respect for the old man, and guessed they would have talked.
"Joe? He's very concerned. Concerned about Jim, and concerned about the damage to relations between the town and the reserve."
"Have you seen Jim?"
His father nodded.
"Saw him this morning. He's not in great shape. He's an outdoors kind of guy. Being locked up is pretty much a death sentence for him."
"What'll happen to him?"
"He'll be shipped down to the district jail in Haileybury. I think he's going on Monday. They got a presiding judge there."
"Who will find him guilty of murder?" Ian said bitterly. "In spite of the fact that the logger must have started it, Jim wouldn't pick a fight."
"His case will be put to the court," his father said.
"By who?"
"The court appoints a defense lawyer."
"Oh, right. The court appoints him, some white guy straight from college who can't get a job anywhere else."
"You're judging them in advance, Ian. You're doing exactly what you're accusing them of doing, making assumptions based on prejudice."
"I'm making assumptions based on Jerry Moynihan and a million guys just like him."
"Jerry's not all bad. He's just a product of his upbringing."
"Yeah, well, his upbringing stinks."
His father sighed. The cheese needed something to go with it. Ian opened the cupboard beside the fridge and took out a box of crackers.
"Want one?"
They ate side by side, looking into the fridge. Ian's anger slowly subsided. He knew it wasn't fair to take it out on his father. He'd be using his influence to do all that he could for Jim.
"We need a dog," he said after a while.
"You're thinking of the stew?"
"Yeah, she's getting worse. Mrs. Tuttle, I mean."
"Oh, well, she does her best," his father said.
"No, she doesn't, Dad."
His father was always making excuses for people. Maybe it was a nice fault, but it was irritating nonetheless. The fridge hummed at them.
Outside, the wind was picking up. A volley of fat raindrops splattered against the kitchen window. Ian liked the sound. The combination of wind and rain always made the house feel safe. "Seriously," he said, "I'd like a dog."
"So would I," his father said musingly. "Maybe we should get one."
They had had a dog once, an Irish setter called Molly, who'd accompanied his father on his rounds for years and who was so much a part of the family that when she died they hadn't been able to bear the thought of getting another because it wouldn't be her. But maybe now the time had come. In fact, Ian saw all at once that it would be perfect. A dog, padding gently around the house, accompanying his father on his rounds, lying at his feet in the evenings. He felt a huge lift of spirits at the thought.
"Yeah," he said. "Let's get one."
"All right. We will."
Ian took out the jar of dill pickle in celebration. He unscrewed the lid, picked out the pickle with his fingers, stuck the end of it in his mouth, poured the vinegar down the sink. The smell of it wafted up like ether. He bit the pickle in half and passed the other half to his father.
"Another Irish setter, do you think? To go with the stew?"
His father nodded around the pickle.
The pickle required more cheese, and the cheese required more crackers.
They ate absently, both lost in thought, crumbs trickling down onto the floor. The various events of the day scrolled backward through Ian's mind.
"Did you know Arthur Dunn had a brother?"
"Yes," his father said. "Jack. No, Jake. Why?"
"He came today, rolled up in an amazing Cadillac."
"Did he really? I haven't seen him for years."
He took the box of crackers from Ian and reached into it. It was empty. He put it down and opened the bread bin and took out the bread.
"He's not much like Arthur, is he?"
Ian said, getting the butter out of the fridge.
"We might as well sit down," his father said. "No, he's a different kettle of fish altogether. I always preferred Arthur, to tell you the truth."
They sat down, bread, butter, and cheese between them. "He's lame," Ian said. "Was it polio?"
"No, an accident. He fell off a bridge. It was a miracle he didn't break his back."
They finished the cheese. Ian got up and opened the cupboard again and started moving jars around.
"Where's the honey?"
"I believe I may have finished it at breakfast."
"The jar was half full, Dad. What did you do, eat it with a spoon?"
"Have some jam."
"You're going to get fat," Ian said.
"I'm looking forward to it."
His father leaned back and patted his paunch fondly. In truth, there wasn't all that much of it yet.
"That reminds me," Ian said. "I want a picture of you."
"What for?"
"To take with me, you know, to throw darts at when I'm away."
"There are lots lying around," his father said vaguely.
"Yeah, but they're old, and they're all out of date. I want an up-to-date one."
There was silence. His father looked at him. He said gently, "You have to forgive her, Ian."
"What?"
As if he didn't know.
"You have to forgive her."
On Sunday mornings when he woke up, he realized that far from having days and days to prepare for the chemistry exam, he now had somewhat less than 30 hours. He skipped church and studied all day. He was good at cramming, even enjoyed it to a degree. There was a kind of masochistic pleasure to be found in concentrating so hard for so long. He took an hour off for supper and then worked till midnight. He got up at 6, had breakfast, and started in again. By 10:30 in the morning, he'd finished. The entire chemistry textbook, a whole year's work, was now inside his head, and provided it didn't all fall out between now and the exam, he'd be fine. He decided to go out and get some air. It would help to consolidate the seething mass of facts inside his head. Then he'd have a sandwich and go and take the exam. Downstairs, patients were trooping in. Monday was always a busy day for his father. People, the considerate ones anyway, saved up their illnesses over the weekend, and the waiting room was jammed. Apart from 6 or 7 adults, there seemed to be about 12 babies, and every one of them was howling. More were on the way.
As he passed the patient's entrance, Mrs. Aronovich, the wife of the chemistry teacher, came in with her little girl in tow, and the little girl was howling too. She was covered in red blotchy spots and looked sick as a dog. "This place is a nightmare," Ian thought, nodding at Mrs. Aronovich and heading for the door. On the doorstep, he paused. Red blotchy spots. He turned on his heel and went back in and caught up with Mrs. Aronovich just as she was about to go into the waiting room. He said, "Excuse me, Mrs. Aronovich, would you mind waiting in the living room?" She turned and looked at him in surprise. Ian said, "Just in case your daughter's got something infectious." He smiled reassuringly at both of them and gestured to the living room across the hall. The little girl stopped howling, which was a relief. Her eyes were so red it hurt even to look at them. "Oh," Mrs. Aronovich said. "Oh, goodness, Ian, of course. Just in case," Ian said. "What with all the babies in there?" He led them into the living room and moved a couple of books off the sofa. "Have a seat. I'll go and tell my father you're here." The little girl croaked something to her mother. "Oh, yes," Mrs. Aronovich said. "She wonders if she could have a drink. Could she have some water?" "I'll ask my dad," Ian said to the child. "I think he'll want to take your temperature first, but then you can probably have one, okay?" He went through the waiting room, stepping over babies and smiling vaguely at people without meeting their eyes so they wouldn't try to start a conversation with him. Mr. Harper, who owned Harper's Restaurant and who, according to Ian's father, had the highest blood pressure on the planet, came out just as he was about to knock on the door. Ian stood aside to let him pass, and then stepped in and closed the door behind him. He said, "Mrs. Aronovich's kid has a red blotchy rash, very red eyes. She looks really sick. I've put her in the living room. It's crawling with babies out there." His father passed his hand over his face. He looked beat already, and the morning wasn't half over. He said, "Thank you. Good thinking." "Where's Margie?" Ian said, looking around. "She has the flu." "She sure picked a good day. This place is a madhouse. Oh, the Aronovich kid's thirsty. Can she have a drink, or do you want to take her temperature first?" His father sighed and looked at his watch. "Are you off to your exam?" "It's not until 1. I was just having a break." His father looked at him consideringly. Ian said quickly, "I was going out for some air." "Oh, okay, fair enough." Which instantly made him feel guilty, of course. He said resignedly, "What did you want me to do?" "No, no, off you go. If you just want me to take your temperature or something." "Are you sure?" "Dad." "Okay, thank you," his father said, capitulating fast. "And while you're doing it, check the inside of her mouth. If there are white spots, it's measles, in which case tell her mother to take her home and give her half an aspirin mashed up with jam. Tell her I'll come as soon as I've finished here. If there are no white spots, I'll see her in the living room." "Okay. Wash your hands." He washed his hands at the sink in the corner, and his father gave him a thermometer. "I owe you," his father said. "I want a camera." His father smiled. "Can she have a drink afterward?" "Small sips." Ian opened the door, and it hit a baby squarely in the seat and sent it sprawling. It had been yelling already, but now it really roared. Nancy Schultz, who had been a year ahead of Ian in school and got pregnant at 15 and now had 3 kids but still no brains, got up to collect it and smiled winningly at him. He resisted the impulse to say, "Nancy, keep your kid out of the doorway or you're dumb or what," because, of course, she was. He went back to the living room. "Okay," he said to the little girl squatting down in front of her. "My dad said I should take your temperature, and then you can have a drink. But first, he wants me to look inside your mouth. Could you open your mouth for me?" She did, and he carefully turned her cheek inside out. White spots. "Well, there you go," he said, as if it were really good news. "You've got measles." "Oh, dear," Mrs. Aronovich said. Ian smiled at her in commiseration. He shook down the thermometer and said to the child, "So, what that means is after I've taken your temperature, I'll get you a drink, and then you and your mum can go home, and my dad will come and see you there later this morning. That's good, eh? You won't have to sit here anymore."
She looked at him dully. She obviously just wished he would leave her alone. He said gently, "I'm going to put this thermometer under your tongue to see how hot it is in there, okay? It has to stay there for 2 minutes. You can time it for me. I'll give you my watch." He slid the thermometer under her tongue. "Don't bite it, okay? Just close your mouth around it. That's good. Keep it like that." He undid his watch and gave it to her. Was she old enough to know what a second hand was? "See the hand that's moving quite fast? When it's gone all the way around twice, we're done." They watched the hand go around. "Don't you have an exam today, Ian?" Mrs. Aronovich said, keeping her voice low so as not to distract her daughter. "Yeah," he grimaced at her. "Chemistry, the last one." "Well, this is good of you." "That's okay. Makes a break. Dad'll go and see her as soon as he finishes here. He says to give her half an aspirin mashed up with jam." "It was her birthday Saturday," Mrs. Aronovich said. "She had a party. She didn't look very well then, but I thought it was the excitement." "Oh, boy," Ian said. It was his father he was thinking of more than the kids. "Maybe you'd better tell my father who was there." "Yes, I will." The little girl was holding his watch and the thermometer out to him. "Wow," Ian said, but quietly, because she looked as if a loud noise would make her head fall off. 104 degrees. That's impressive." He might have been mistaken, but he thought she almost smiled. He went down to the lake and sat on the dock for a while, staring into the water and not thinking about anything much. Around noon, his father came down. "I'm off to see the Aronovich child," he said. "Thanks for your help this morning." "That's okay. I guess you'll be gone by the time I get back." "Yeah, we're all going out to Lowdown. I'm not sure when it starts. I probably won't be in for supper." "That's fine. Have fun. By the way, I heard some news this morning that'll interest you. I had a call from Jerry Moynihan. Jim Lightfoot escaped from jail last night." Ian looked up at him. "You're kidding." "Jerry went in this morning to give him his breakfast, and the jail was empty." "How did he get out?" Ian said. "Does Jerry know?" "Oh, yes, he knows. Hard to miss it. They cut a hole in the roof." "The roof!" Ian gave a hoot of laughter. "That's great." "It may not end up being so great. The RCMP are involved now. As far as they're concerned, a suspected murderer is on the loose." "They'll never get him. He'll have lit off into the woods." "Of course. But they'll be all over the reserve looking for whoever was involved. Things are going to be pretty unpleasant." Ian thought about Pete, wondering if he would have been in on it. More than likely. "I still think it's great," he said. He was half expecting Pete not to turn up for the exam, but he was there, not even late this time, waiting in the hall with everyone else. "How are things?" Ian said cautiously, leaning against the wall beside him. "Not too bad." "I heard about the jailbreak." Pete looked at him. "Me too." "The Mounties there yet?" "They're everywhere, man. Coming out of the woodwork, crawling up the walls. You can't go for a crap without finding a Mountie in there sniffing around." He grinned. He looked as if he'd just won $1 million. Mr. Aronovich arrived, and they filed into the room and sat down. They were pros at this now. It was almost a shame it was all coming to an end. Aronovich handed out the papers and said, "Ready, set, go," and they all flipped the paper over and started scribbling. For 3 hours, Ian poured out onto the paper everything he'd taken in the past 2 days, and when it was over, his brain felt as empty as an old boot. Nothing in there at all. Afterward, they milled around, restlessly, talking about how great it felt to be finished, but how it didn't seem real, and how it was going to take a long time to sink in. Somebody suggested they go to Harper's, but Ian decided against it. You could predict exactly what the conversation would be. They'd do a post-mortem on the exam, question by question, until they'd all convinced themselves they'd failed. He didn't fancy it. He caught Pete's eye and nodded questioningly at the door, and Pete nodded in reply. Ian felt a huge relief. Almost as good as Jim Lightfoot getting away was the fact that Pete seemed to be back to normal. Their fishing tackle was at Pete's.
and his grandfather had told him to stay out of the way of the Mounties, so they decided to hike up to the Leap. It had been years since either of them had been there. Fishing was so addictive it left time for nothing else. The Leap was a sheer granite cliff over 300 feet high, rising up out of the lake. It might have been possible to scale it if you had the right equipment, but as far as anyone knew, it had never been done. Instead, you approached it from the rear, where the climb was merely steep rather than precipitous. They went past Kathy's house to pick up Ian's bike, cycled to the point where the road came closest to the Leap, and then abandoned their bikes and set off. The going was easy at first, rising gently across great, rounded humps of pink, lichen-encrusted granite, bare but for the occasional tuft of grass or rich green pillow of moss. Here and there, in hollows deep enough for a little soil to gather, there was a knotted jackpine hanging on tight. Then the rocks got steeper, and they had to pick their way, climbing as fast as they could, both feeling the urge to push themselves physically to get the blood moving again after the concentrated mental effort of the morning. Partway up, there was a giant turtle-shaped boulder they remembered sitting on as kids, so they climbed up and sat on it again to get their breath back. "It was your grandfather who brought us here the first time, wasn't it?" Ian said breathlessly. "Years ago, we were really young." Pete nodded. "Was it your birthday or something?" "Yeah." Ian had a dim memory of the old man helping him up a rock, saying something encouraging to him in a language he didn't understand, then saying it again in English. "There, now, up this one. Good, good." He was a great old guy. And now there were Mounties prowling around the store, asking questions. "How's he doing, you know, with everything that's going on?" "He's okay. Worried?" "About Jim?" "About everything, man. About everything." Below them, a couple of crows were bouncing about on a boulder, yelling at each other. Then a third crow joined them and added his opinion. Then a fourth. They stood around,